Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hey there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
You got a fun capri. You got, like, a shirt that is somewhere in between, like fun mod and a little bit like young mom shirts. Like
young mom shirt? I beg your pardon. I will say, though, that Silas really likes the glowy stickers on this.
I just imagine it would, like, captivate him. And pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Toxin.
Hey, Guy.
Hi, Rocketeers.
Karen, how you doing?
I'm doing great. A little worse for the wear, but that always happens.
You had yourself a weekend?
Had a weekend. I was at the LA Times book fair doing important conversational things about Me Too. And then I played a lesbian magician in my friend's play at the Barnsdall
Art Park.
Yeah, you
did so much this weekend, Karen.
It was a lot. It was a big weekend.
I mean, you wore like a beard and a hat and a bow tie for a little while?
Yeah, it was not quite a beard, just, you know, lesbian facial hair.
Margaret,
yeah.
Did you Festival of Books?
I didn't. I didn't go this year, and I almost don't know who I am.
I know. It's an important part of who you are and what you do.
It's my brand, but I just decided to take this year off.
Hey,
nice. Everybody needs some time away.
Yeah, it's been like a good 10 years that I've been representing at that thing.
Got to keep a balance. You guys did not hear the familiar hello hello of digital strategist Winnie Mitchell because she's taking some time off to strategize for her wedding. But starting next week, Andrew T. from Yo Is This Racist will be filling in for Winnie for the next couple of weeks while she's away. And we miss Winnie,
so
but
excited.
We're excited to have Andrew here. But back to the LA Festival of Books. You know, Margaret, it happens to be true that I have a book that is coming out in a couple of months.
That's right, Guy. Tell me all about it.
Well, it is called My Life as a Goddess, and it is currently available for pre-order if any Rocketeers would like stories of me whining about how hard it was to grow up in a farm town or analyzing pop culture just like I do on this show, but in print form. Doesn't it sound
juicy.
Delightful? Coming up on this week's show, we say goodbye to Scandal, and we take a look at the other female anti-heroines we've come to love. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest gems. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen Tongson, what are you all about this week?
There's something that's very cute that's about to come out, and it is a Pixar short called Bao. And Bao, as some of you may know, is the word for dumpling.
Yes.
And it is also a word for gift or treasure. Mm. And the premise of Bao is that a Chinese Canadian mother specifically, who has become empty nested, sees one of her dumplings, her Bao, come to life. Like a little baby.
That's adorable.
Yeah.
That is really cute.
Like, in the trailer that they've released so far, you see this little dumpling start to wake up and its little arms pop out and its mouth open. It's so adorable. And the whole time I'm thinking, man, you must be tasty. But, I mean, it's going to premiere officially with The Incredibles 2 on June 15th. But I was just so taken by this because, you know, in terms of cinematic Asian American entertainment or Asian entertainment or Chinese Canadian entertainment, there still isn't a wide swath of stuff. We also saw the preview for Crazy Rich Asians, which doesn't come out until August. But frankly, in the animated world, you have your Mulan. And for Pacific Islanders, you have Moana. I mean, I can't really think of other things. Especially not, this is the first, I think, Asian themed Pixar film specifically.
Well, there was Sanjay's Super Team, which was South Asian, which was a short that ran before The Good Dinosaur, I think. I just remember I went and saw a Pixar movie I did not want to see so that I could see Sanjay's Super Team, which was about a South Asian kid learning to love his religion. Hindu. He was a Hindu kid. Pixar appears to be sort of like giving these shorts to diverse voices to try to like build a team of people who are able to give them a greater diversity of perspectives in filmmaking.
Well, and I should also add that the director for Bao is Domi Shi, who is actually the first female director ever of a Pixar short.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's also surprising. And I just, you know, I wanted to share one of the things she says about Bao. And she said she wanted to create, quote, this magical modern day fairy tale, kind of like a Chinese gingerbread man story. So I think it's going to be like really lovely and heartwarming. It's going to be like the short tastier version of Joyla Club. Because it's all going to be about the mom.
But less, I don't think nearly as many concubines, right?
Not nearly as many concubines, not as many worst quality crabs for best quality heart. But, you know, there's that, you know, that thing, especially anybody who has any Asian person out there who has mommy issues. I know many of us do. This will warm the cockles of our hearts.
How frequently do people threaten to eat or cook Silas?
I do every day. I mean, I munch on his face and I've lost the ability not to do that to like adults when I hug them. It's a problem.
Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I read this article in The Cut, which is, you know, New York Magazine's lady portal online, and it was all about children being raised gender creative. They're called babies, and it's basically children that are raised, you know, they're born with certain sex characteristics, but their parents decide not to tell anyone what those sex characteristics are, and they just raise them. They don't say without gender or gender neutral. They like to say like open gendered or gender fluid or gender creative. And it's a really fascinating article. All of the babies or thabies in the story have really androgynous names like Storm and Sojourner Wildfire or something like that. It's super interesting. It's by Alex Morris. You can also follow some of the babies online. On Instagram, I'm following an account called Raising Zoomer. Zoomer is one of the babies. And it's very interesting to encounter the baby this way, because basically in my feed, I have lots of friends who have children. And so when I just am scrolling through, there's Zoomer and he or she looks, or they looks like anybody else.
Yeah.
And presents as anyone else. And I've been thinking about this a lot too, because anytime I ever try to buy clothes for Silas, and I'm not raising him gender creative necessarily, I'm sticking to the script more or less, but I also don't want to buy onesies that have trucks all over them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how difficult it is at the age of babyhood to break out of those norms. Out of those prescriptive clothing norms.
Well, it's weird the way we have to be so aggressive with it with children, because that's where they learn, like, mm-hmm. that entire game is gendered the whole way up. Toys, clothes, everything. It's so hard because, like, we don't know how much stuff to uproot in the process of trying to get rid of the worst parts of what gender can mean. It is just unfortunate that the people who are the brave pioneers in this territory are also dirty hippies in the bad ways, too.
This is the thing, yeah. Is that they're not hippies. They're, like, polished Instagram people.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. Wow. That's what's so fascinating
part of
about
their brand.
It. It's part of their brand. I mean, there's a gender studies professor that's Zoomer's dad.
Wow.
It's a different breed than you would think. I mean, and I don't mean to say that people haven't raised like valid points of concern, you know, that like how will these children sort themselves out in a society that unfortunately does sort things into binaries all too often.
Well, I mean, thing is just like, as a Jew who lived in America, I learned Christian stuff, you know, like you pick it up.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think that I was at all raised as a baby. I think that my mother had a very strong and powerful will to feminize me from a very, very small age, but I was super resistant to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were other people who indulged my babiness.
Yeah.
Like my grandmother, for example. I read about this a little bit in the Karen Carpenter book that's going to come out. And I honestly feel like it wasn't until I arrived at school or in these other kind of social environments where I began to self-discipline around my own gender presentation, you know, after so many, because I didn't care about it as a little child as much, and I didn't mind being mistaken for the other gender, the wrong gender. And then it wasn't until it became really painful in these kind of social schoolyard contexts that then I started to maybe listen to my mother a little bit more, you know, and kind of conform to certain gender norms.
Yeah, I mean, I used to have a fight with my parents every Sunday because I wanted to always just dress in my Spider-Man t-shirt and cords. And they were like, put a dress on and be a girl for church. And I never wanted to do it. And I look back on that whole year and just wonder what direction I would have gone in if they had been like, great, you can dress like that. If you want to wear your brother's tie, that's fine. Like, I'm not sure what would have happened. Yeah. I mean, back then it was like that was just a tomboy. That was just a stage.
Gender is a prison, everybody. So what am I all about this week? Well, one thing you should know about me is I love to go get extremely stoned and then go to a mass market comedy. And earlier this week, I went to Blockers, which Riley had said was amazing. And was fucking amazing. You have to go see this movie.
Oh, I did see it.
Oh, you did?
And my wife was stoned.
Oh.
And she laughed harder than I did, but I still laughed a lot.
But I mean, there's so much about it that's so good. The fact that, like, just the notion of, in the same week that we have that photo of, like, the ex-NFL player with a gun in his daughter's, prom photo, that it was a movie that fundamentally questioned the degree to which, like, parents, particularly fathers, need to be sort of like treating their daughter's virginity as their property.
Oh, God, creepy. And wait, what's it about? What is this movie about?
So it's about three parents whose daughters are all like the best of friends. And it's their prom night. And the girls make a pact that they're going to all have sex. And
losing it.
Two of the parents.
Yeah.
Two of the parents are trying to stop it. And then one of the other parents, realizing that his daughter is gay and just hasn't like dealt with it herself, he eventually tries to stop her from having sex with a man so that when she does it for the first time, it will be a real thing. Also, I should properly explain, I was sad that I had not gotten to enjoy that movie stoned, so I went and saw I Feel Pretty immediately before coming here stoned. So,
oh yeah.
What a lovely movie. Like the work, it's super, super funny. Amy Schumer is a much better actress than I realized. Like, there are the moments when the premise of the movie is that she watches Big and wishes she was pretty. The next day, she, like, bumps her head in a spin class and then starts thinking she's pretty, even though she still looks like Amy Schumer, which is still pretty, pretty under, for by my conception. I am stoned. but, the like, those moments where she is first looking in the mirror, she does all of this work that feels so amazingly real and visceral, and you like get it. There's something, it's basically taking one of those transformation movies we saw during the 80s and 90s and just not having the person transform. Mm-hmm. Like, it's super fun. And then in the moment when she thinks that it has been taken away from her, again, is just doing astoundingly good work. Michelle Williams is hilarious and giving us so much. But more than anything, there's just this tradition of, I mean, one of the great things about Blockers is that it was directed by Kay Cannon. And this movie was co-directed by a woman and a man and also co-written. And I just feel like there has been this thread in female-targeted comedies over the course of the past couple of years that is a generosity with all of the characters involved. Like the way that Rose Byrne in Bridesmaids isn't just a villainess. She is somebody who by the end of it you like understand. And this movie did a bunch of things that I thought were going to turn in much more sort of like trite directions, and it ended up being lovely. And then finally, Rory Scovel is like, he's a comic who plays her love interest in it, is better at dancing backwards romantic comedy style than anybody since Hugh Grant. Like, really does that job of making the insanity work by playing along.
You know, when I've seen the trailers for it, and I really want to see I Feel Pretty. But I also think of it as a kind of like, I don't know, payback for Shallow Hal to a certain extent, right? Because it kind of reverses that process of, instead of like seeing it through and altering the dude's gaze, right? Like the male gaze, you know, towards this woman and seeing her as pretty and, you know, or conventionally pretty, conventionally sized, and then finding her attractive. It allows the woman to undergo that sensation and transformation and all, I mean, or non-trans, you know, that transformative perspective versus like physical transformation. And I'm just like, how do, I mean, you know, when I think back, I was like, I can't believe they actually made that movie.
Yeah. I've been hearing though a critique about I Feel Pretty, which is that it makes it seem that women, if they just had confidence, could have all their problems solved, and it doesn't account for the fact that, like, society hates us if we're not a size two.
Like, there is a very, like, lean-in sentiment to this, hey, gals, if only you were thinking the right way.
And, right, buck and up and do it.
And I think that plays into ideas like The Secret and this notion that if you're not getting it, you don't want it badly enough or whatever. I thought that it managed to play a very specific game. Like, it managed to feel like earned. Also, I'm still stoned. I liked it. The end. All right. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Scandal and female anti-heroes right after the break.
Welcome, everyone, to the live wrestling spectacular in Los Angeles.
So far, the world's most boring wrestling podcast has been destroying the competition.
Isn't there anyone who can save us from this travesty?
Wait, could it be?
It's Tights and Fights, the perfect wrestling podcast.
Tights and Fights is here to save us from the monotony of boring wrestling podcasts with hilarious conversations.
Woke trips through the history of wrestling.
And joke about the finer points of people wearing spandex.
What a match!
And the Tights and Fights podcast will be back every week.
Thursdays on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts. Please, these hosts have families.
Tights and Fights podcast. Tights and Fights.
Welcome back to Pod Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler
and Karen Tongson.
And Olivia Pope entered our lives in April of 2012. And this past Friday, we said goodbye to her as Scandal aired its last episode titled Over a Cliff. Whether you thought the show ended with a bang or a whimper might depend on how big a fan of the series you were. Regardless of where you stand, the show's impact was undeniable. What was your relationship to Scandal?
I started late. I think it was in the, like, towards the end of the first season, that first run of episodes. But then once I started watching, I remember very distinctly when I started watching, because Sarah and I were just at home, like, let's try this show. It was about 10 p.m. Sarah got stoned. We have a theme. Made some banana bread. Next thing you know, it's 4 a.m. and we're still watching Scandal. And so we got hooked right away. And I think that I pretty much stayed with it all the way through season 3 and then took some pauses. But I've always dipped back in. Whenever I, like, you know, end up with a cache of episodes, I'll come back and I'll just binge all of them. And I always try to recreate that first sensation, because that's what this show was so good at, was like creating this kind of cliffhanger drama filled with intrigue that you just couldn't stop watching.
Margaret, what about you?
I was really late to it. In fact, I didn't get to it until last year, and that was because I had an assignment to interview Kerry Washington about a season of Scandal. And so what I did actually was post on our Facebook group and asked our wise listeners to guide me through Scandal, like, which seasons should I watch? What should I be aware of as the character moved forward? And if anybody's looking to jump into the show, I highly recommend joining our Facebook group for multiple reasons, but look up that Scandal thread, because, I mean, everyone killed it.
Yeah.
Like, I just got a complete tutorial about going through the whole series. And what I ended up doing was watching the first two seasons, and I really loved it. I thought it was super sharp. Olivia Pope, played by Kerry Washington, of course, is a really compelling character. A real hot mess, personally, but professionally, always cleaning up the messes, wearing sumptuous cashmere. You gotta love that in a lady.
Never spilling the giant goblet of wine unless she's in peril in some way.
Yeah, and it is always like a giant fishbowl of wine that she has in her hand. So I thought those first two seasons were super sharp, and then I kind of dipped in and around other seasons, and I think it did lose the thread, but it almost didn't matter. You know, I think at a certain point, people watched it because they loved what the product of Scandal was, which was just this Olivia Pope, fierce, can't be outwitted kind of character, always prevailing one way or another.
I started watching it because in 2013, I was working with our producer, Laura Swisher, on a show called Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. And the producers on the show were so obsessed with this show that, like, if I wanted to have a conversation with any of them, I was going to have to do it. And so that was, like, midway through season two. And I... That first season, I mean, it goes down real sweet.
Oh, yes.
And as somebody who... I always loved The West Wing, and it was like being political, but also the first and second season were so procedural. They were like, we're going to solve this problem. And as things got soapier and bigger...
More conspiratorial,
yes,
too.
Yes. Like, that aspect of things, when you're... By the end of that show, it was essentially sci-fi. And that was... My problem is that, like, I loved the energies of the show so much and also, like, the nobility of the show so much. But it went into this conspiratorial place where I no longer... I just didn't know what relationship I had to it. And I kind of wanted to watch Olivia Pope in a different world, you know, like I wanted to see her in a more realistic world. It's interesting to me that Grey's Anatomy has been going for 15 years and I believe has been picked up for the next 37. but that Shonda was like, we're done with Scandal. Why?
I think that it became unsustainable to, yeah, you know, because there were, I remember earlier on in the earlier seasons, one of the things that Scandal was most effective at was really harnessing social media.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, many of the stories saying, bidding farewell to Scandal, have Kerry Washington talking about how she just got this idea. Hey, what if the cast live tweeted while the series was on and created a kind of water cooler hashtag-y, yeah, buzz? And I remember when they were like, the twisty, turny episodes, you know, like they were really pushing the bait and switch aspect of the series. I think that, you know, being that sensational and maintaining such a high pitch over such a durational period just isn't possible.
Well, you've also just, they had squeezed so much out of all of those characters. Like, you know, I was not in the show for the past couple of seasons, and it was weird to show up and, like, with Cyrus as the great evil. And, you
but
know.
But he's always been sort of evil. He's like, that's the thing is, everyone on the show has been profoundly evil and terrible and,
yeah,
also very good. So, or, you know, and it was, and it is fundamentally, you know, a struggle between good and evil,
yeah,
right? And that's where the show lands and lands hard. But, I mean, you know, I think that at a certain point, you know, you wonder, especially like with, you know, this last season was really difficult to watch because Liv started to become completely vilified, right?
Yeah.
And it almost became Lord of the Ringsy.
Yeah.
Because it was just like, and especially, I think that they were really self-aware of this because they kept referring to the oval, grabbing the oval. And it was just like, it's the one ring, you know, it's like the circle, the Eye of Sauron, or, you know, whatever it is. But
yeah, that has some Game of Thrones overtones for,
yeah,
sure.
I have just been rewatching a bunch of The West Wing, mm-hmm, which is such an interesting show that, like, started up in, like, let's imagine a better Clinton, and then was suddenly having to wrestle with George W. Bush, post 9/11. And there's something interesting in looking at Scandal as a show that, like, started out playing a fun game of ooh Scandal with a presidency that we could, like, believe in, and we're talking about Scandal was, like, fun and cute, and then had to spend the last 2 years in a world that felt like it was plausible that the First Lady could become the Republican candidate for president a couple of years later. Who knows? But yeah, it got into this world that was, like, so distanced. Let's talk about other sort of female anti-heroes who we've seen on TV. Because, like, this was a show, like, yes, it was significant and exciting to have a black woman at the center of a show about politics and power like that. But it's also just, we haven't seen a great number of women at the center of shows about stuff like that, or who got the, like, privilege of being able to be a complex and not just sort of, like, uniformly great person.
I have been watching the latest season of Unreal, which I talked about, I don't know, maybe three or four shows ago as my all about. And I'm happy to see that I think it's recovered pretty well from the faltering steps of the second season. I can't say I'm like wholly convinced that it's found its voice 100%, but it's better for sure. And I was really, I'm still gratified watching the show because I think that the two leads played by Shira Appleby and Constance Zimmer are just so good. And even when the show makes some very pretty ridiculous hairpins in terms of what we can believe a character will do, those two are just so committed that I'll go anywhere with them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that one of the interesting crossovers, obviously, or the kind of parallels that we can draw between Unreal and Scandal is, you know, it's interesting that these anti-heroic or like ambiguously moral female leads and characters are at the center of such hairpin plot turns, right? They are at the center of these twisty, turny type of dramas. I think that one of the things that I love is about Unreal is its exploration of feminism, not just as in a kind of rah-rah, hey, that's awesome way, but that, you know, points out the ways in which women themselves instrumentalize feminism to get certain things that they want.
Yeah.
Positions themselves in certain ways. At the same time, you see, like, in Rachel's character, a real kind of core commitment to certain, like, social values and social justice values. But coming out through this weird warp, in this weird warped way, because that's kind of all that television can do is, like, put it through, run it through the sausage mill and, you know.
Yeah, well, in a way, I think it's a critique of a certain strain of feminism, which is like, be like a man, do it like a man. Mm-hmm. You know, in the sense that these two are super cutthroat, and in a way, that industry that they're in, TV, reality TV specifically, promotes that. And so in a certain sense, you're like, well, don't they have to do this to get ahead? And so that's a really morally ambiguous place to be as a viewer, where you're like, okay, on one hand, you're sort of rooting for them because fuck it, this world is dark, and like, let them cut people and get ahead. And on the, and then on the other hand, it's like, there's horrible, repugnant things that they're doing. And I think what's so interesting too about Rachel as an anti-heroine is that she often presents to different characters on the show is like that gal pal that you have in the class or at work who, like, you can just be like, psst, come here, and like gossip to her about like a bad date you had last night or whatever. And so they take that really like friendly, chatty girl prototype and just twist it.
Like, but do women get to be anti-heroes in the same way that men do? I feel like there is a way that we still have this expectation of at least like emotional fidelity from these female antiheroes. And like Shiri Appleby on Unreal is maybe one of the best exceptions from that that we have, because like she does fuck dudes over. But I just feel like there is this way that we still are stuck with believing that this person is capital G good that we never had to commit to with a Tony Soprano or a Walter White.
Although that's something that they did explore with Olivia Pope on Scandal, fundamentally. That's something that they really had to work through and work out. And with Quinn on Unreal, I feel like there are humanizing moments, but there's never, at least thus far, through three whole seasons, there's never been the effort to, you know, imply that Quinn is in any way good, but she is complex. She is emotionally rich. She is, you know, Constance Zimmer is brilliant in that role.
Yeah. I do think in a weird way she's presented almost like the way some people describe Trump, like, well, he's honest, all the disgustingness is on the outside, and therefore you can root for him. You know, that kind of like backwards idea. I think that's like embedded in her character, that like Rachel is actually more the snake in the grass because she presents as the best girlfriend.
Well, the wonderful thing about that show is like the moment you see Quinn, you see all of the forces that made her.
Yeah.
Where when it comes to, what is Shiri Appleby's character name?
Rachel.
Rachel, you're like, that's a mental imbalance. Like, that's that's the special skills and abilities that come with borderline personality disorder.
We should get Megan back on.
For sure. I mean, Tony Soprano, it's interesting to talk about him because I feel like everyone always knew he was a murderer, but yet you still sympathize with certain decisions.
He's a good guy. He loves pasta.
Yeah. And he likes the History Channel. Like that he was kind of like the everymanness of him was supposed to make you feel some sort of warmth towards him.
There's something so interesting about the past 15 to 20 years of queering perspective and right and wrong in stuff. I feel like Game of Thrones is such an interesting example of that because it's been so constantly telling stories that ask you to identify with people who are at odds with each other. And we're getting to a point where we still think of Jaime as good and we still think of Jon Snow as good. And where is that going to end up? And I feel like he is working to deny us a clean sense of good and evil. And I'm just interested in why everyone, after so many years of having white hats and black hats, why we fell in love with ambiguity in 1998.
In 1998 specifically?
Specifically.
With Tony Soprano, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that moral ambiguity, maybe it was post-Clinton impeachment, maybe it was the sense that this guy we thought, like, you know, was going to lead us out of the kind of darkness and, you know, a place called hope, you know, the man from a place called hope was going to fix things. But everybody fundamentally is just kind of bad and cheating on their wives and lying to people about it. And, you know, I mean, the kind of source material of Scandal, for example, comes from that. One of the things about these two shows that we've been talking about largely so far, Unreal and Scandal, is that these female anti-heroes have to be at the very, very highest echelons of power. One in Washington, right? And the set of two in Hollywood. And you know, part of what it does is it's, you know, like it anchors this anti-heroism beyond like the sphere of the everyday, beyond the sphere of everyday life. It's something extraordinary and special, whereas you can get a Walter White in Breaking Bad who's just a school teacher who, you know, who happens to have cancer and like therefore breaks bad. Or even, you know, even somebody like Don Draper, who, you know, sure, we're talking about advertising this big institution, but you also, you know, it's just like the kind of daily life, like daily suburban, like mid-century life that you see being kind of portrayed.
Well, it strikes me too that when it comes to female anti-heroines, it seems like they are doing the bad things because society makes them do those bad things. Like if you take the Cersei Game of Thrones model, like the only way she's going to get any kind of power is by being a total cutthroat bitch.
And I mean, that's kind of what Itania was like, you know, what else is she supposed to do?
Right. She's a product of her time and place. So there's that. But then there's the...
That interestingly segues with what Karen was saying, where like if a lady is fancy and rich and has like beautiful knit sweaters in a neutral color, it's an anti-heroine. But when it's Itania, she's trash. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just like, ha-ha, look at the trash. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, the other thing I was going to point out is that I think the other way we can have an anti-heroine, which is definitely the Carrie-on Homeland model, which is mental illness, right? Yeah. She's bipolar. She's amazing at what she does, but her bipolarness is always presented as this absolute wild card that it can undo her at any minute.
So would you say that it is a situation of women have to be in a situation that they can't help, where men are sort of more allowed to make choices?
I think so. I think that there is definitely always underneath the fabric of the character, like, a reason that they are like this. It's like, I mean, even Rachel on Unreal, it's like her mother is this completely sick therapist who, like, abused her. And that's the rationale for what she does now. Whereas I don't feel like, I mean, in Tony Soprano, he had, like, a really horrible mother with borderline personality disorder. But I don't think that was ever really presented as, like, that's the reason he's like this, folks. That's the reason he went to the mob. Whereas I do think with women, there's always like, well, there's a reason she's so messed up.
Although, I mean, I suppose you could say that about Olivia Pope, although, it's, you know, because she also has the domineering mother who is a kind of ambiguous, like, or ambiguously a terrorist and sometimes works in her favor, or her father, Rowan, who always pushed her in these particular ways. But I think that with something like Scandal, though, what you see in it and what makes Olivia Pope so compelling is that actually you see how systemic forms of racism, like the kind of structural powers that forged her experience coming up in Washington, are what shade her moralities in, to a certain extent, right? That's like what creates that shading in her approach to morality. But to go back to why 1998, and maybe I'll answer this through like why might we have a preponderance of anti-heroines after 1998? Maybe it's because we got to know Hillary Clinton really well over a period of time, too. And that's where you get your Claire Underwoods. You get Melly on Scandal. You get The Good Wife. You get, you know, and some of the characters. I mean, you know, they're all kind of adjacent to these very powerful women whose power we at once admire and find dubious in certain ways, and wonder about their emotional and, you know, core, and whether or not they have a heart.
I'd never thought about it before, but there is an interesting way that a story about Olivia Pope had to turn into conspiracies and gigantic stuff and essentially a superhero show, because Olivia Pope at the center of the West Wing is never the center of the West Wing.
Yeah.
You know, like putting her in a position of centrality in a conversation about American government, that alone takes us outside of the traditional narrative of American government. And then where are you going to go from there?
Yeah, it also strikes me, too, that like we got the anti-heroine now or post-1998 that's shaped by her industry or her job.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like the older anti-heroine, the kind of role that like a Betty Davis would have played or something, it would have been much more forged around like family and domesticity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like not anything to do with whatever her chosen career would be, because back in the 40s and 50s, that's just not on the plate for women.
Yeah.
Whereas I think now, you know, it's like, yeah, Washington will make you into a monster. Hollywood will make you into a monster. Reality TV, et cetera.
At Mad Madding Crowd on Twitter compared unreal characters to Isabelle Huppert in Elle. He said, female fantasies of women with dark souls, but who are gorgeous, competent, and smarter, and more vulgar than everyone around them, especially men, can be passionate, but don't know they can rely on men or romance, strong professional relationships with another woman, and both about women who produce arguably misogynistic entertainment. How do you think women, like female writers, female creators, create the idea of a fantasy woman, of the woman that they want to be?
So do you mean the fantasy of the ideal woman, the kind of like normative fantasy of the ideal woman, or these heroic women who we've been talking about, or anti-heroic women who we've been talking about?
I think the person with so much juice in them that you really want to get in her head and you kind of want to be her. Because, of course, the way men have written that woman was that you never get inside of her head. You get inside other parts of her, and that's all you could possibly want from them. And it is interesting letting, like, female creators give us these, like, complex and flawed, but like really aspirational characters, you know, like Rachel in Unreal. Every time you see her, you're like, she's got it, you know, like same with Olivia Pope.
Well, I do think Shonda Rhimes has been talking about how what is real achievement is when a female character can be just as fucked up as a male character. Like, she can be just as multidimensional and prismatic as any guy on TV, and it doesn't even have to be a thing. And I think that that is something that Scandal has really created as its legacy, is like, basically, it's birthed all these other complicated, or even just not your typical sitcom-y kind of female character anchoring a show.
Well, that first episode of How to Get Away with Murder, when Viola Davis gets eaten out on her desk, really was just kind of like, all right, like this is not, she's so competent and good at her job, and then we never deal with it ever again. Like, this is somebody whose existence was being aggrandized. And that's exciting. It's not something we saw in 1996.
No, I mean, the fact that they gave Shonda Rhimes 3 hours on ABC on Thursday night, like the golden crown of TV, just to tell her stories. I mean, that to me is just such a huge statement about whose stories do we want to hear now? Whose stories do we get to hear now? And I think, like, you know, all the shows like Black-ish and Fresh Off the Boat and, you know, other shows, One Day at a Time, like all these shows that have like an unconventional character at the center. And I only say unconventional comparing it to just millions of white people that have anchored shows for all time. Like, that is the legacy of Scandal to me. And so, like, in a way, it's like, you know, even though it went off the rails in a sense, it's like it's
well, and it's not just
it set the rails.
It's not just ABC realized, hey, casting an entire show with white people isn't the, like we can. There are other things we can do. Scandal created a series of professional successes from executives who were then able to go to other places and start spreading this gospel of, hey, there's a new and different world that we could be talking about. Yeah, I mean, it also paved the way for something like Empire, which is much less real, but also, I mean, Cookie Lyon's a fucking great character.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely iconic. And like, and that's a whole black cast.
Yeah, and it's also just a world we all knew about that we hadn't seen before. And like, Scandal does a really good job of taking like a type of show that we have seen before and putting somebody... like putting a black woman at the center of it, which we hadn't seen, but going into like a world like hip hop that we all understand so well, but have not explored on TV because, you know, we didn't make movies with, or we didn't make TV shows with that many black people in them.
And also they made really good, I mean, I don't know, they're really good nighttime soaps, frankly, right? You know, that's the thing is that we've sort of, for a period of time, we veered towards these realist dramas or dramedies that were, or procedurals that were anchoring prime time. And we sort of lost that kind of, the kind of glitz and intensity of some of those nighttime soaps we had in the 80s. And I think shows like even like Grey's, which also sort of started the kind of Shonda empire, you know, and Scandal, it's, you know, like Shonda Rhimes showed us that you could have a really smart soap again. And I think part of what Unreal does is it also presents to us a really smart soap that's a reflection on the very medium of television itself.
And of the other kind of soaps that we watch right
now. Yeah, totally.
Let's talk a little bit about Glamour and Scandal. And I hadn't thought about it before, but it was completely a show that I kept watching longer than I would have just to see what the buttons on her coat were going to look like. And I had not thought about it in the tradition of things like Dynasty. But it really was us watching with the same kind of sort of like material culture passion for it. It was just like a more muted and tasteful version.
Yeah, it was like high power black bouginess, which involved like cream colored Burberry jackets, a lot of cream colored pillows,
a perfectly cinched trench coat.
Yeah, and also like, let's talk a little bit about the, you know, OPA, Olivia Pope and Associates, like their office with that window. The cracked window that they'd always tape all the pictures to and like that. Like that, you know, and that, and I was noticing it in the last episode, that gorgeous table in the middle.
Yeah.
Like with all of the kind of interlocking, like it's some sort of like Danish thing. Like, you know, with the
interlocking
styles of wood.
Aspect
and
of Danish things.
Whatever. But I mean, yeah, so stylistically too, it presented us this kind of, I mean, and she and her father, Olivia and her father, were big wine connoisseurs as well. So this particular kind of level of like black bouginess in the echelons of power.
Also, it was just, she just looked gorgeous. I mean, Kerry Washington never didn't look gorgeous in that entire show. And there's something so nice about being able to have a superhero like that and being able to like imagine, who am I when I'm that lady?
I think that's another way in which the Shonda's productions have emboldened Kerry Washington. I mean, she started her own production company. She made that movie based on Anita Hill's life and starred in it, and it was a wonderful picture. I think that, like, it's also about that. Just, like, the people that she works with and touches their lives, she's basically emboldened those people to go on and do amazing things.
We all want Joss Malina to have a nice income. it was very sad when he died. All right. We, of course, want to hear what you think about the finale of Scandal, about anti-heroes. Give us your thoughts on the Facebook group. All right. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this.
Podcasts. They're audio programs that
tell smart stories
in innovative ways
using editing techniques like this.
But let's face it, all that smart stuff can be exhausting.
That's where Stop Podcasting Yourself comes in.
It's so stupid.
It's just two stupid dinguses
being dumb idiot jerks for 90 minutes.
Stop Podcasting Yourself.
The stupid show that smart people love.
Find it on iTunes
or MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler
and Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask that age-old question, what's your current jam? So I will turn to Karen Tongson and say, Karen Tongson, what is your current jam?
My current jam is a jam that I've had for a very long time, but it gives me tremendous pleasure every time I hear it. It also always makes me feel like such an urban sophisticate, kind of like I did when I was 12 and was first listening to this music. It's Joe Jackson's Steppin' Out from 1982.
Yes.
You hear just a little bit of it, you've heard the whole thing.
So fine, look and dry your eyes.
I love the song because it's so simple and it has that driving. It's kind of like, it has that new wave feel to it, but it's not new wave. It's a little dorkier than that. Like, and Joe Jackson himself was kind of, experimenting with new wave before he kind of leaned into more jazz fusion-y stuff. His first big hit was Is She Really Going Out With Him, which
another
is very
good
like,
one.
You know, another good one, which was very like pseudo Elvis Costello.
Yes. Yeah.
But Steppin' Out is so good. And he had another really great song from 1983. The title is eluding me, but that was, I think, you know, his peak moment in pop culture. I think Steppin' Out is maybe not a four quadrant song. I don't necessarily envision
it's 100% a one quadrant
at least
driving
two
song.
Quadrants driving and getting ready.
Yeah, yeah. Like you cannot hit the brakes when you're listening to
and
that
you might
song.
Be able to clean to it as well, but yeah. I don't know about the dump, you know.
Yeah, you have to be a certain kind of person.
Yeah, for sure.
I think I am that kind of person. Margaret Wappler, what is your current jam?
My current jam is from Sampha, who is an English musician that has worked with so many of my favorite people and probably your favorite people too. Solange, Drake, Kanye. He's just been all over the place. He's like one of those guys that's just like the collaborator of all collaborators. And he had this album come out last year called Process, which ended up winning the Mercury Prize, which is like that prize that people win and like 2 years later you're like, oh yeah, that was a good album. I feel like it takes a while for their work to surface sometimes, those Mercury Prize people. So this is a track called Nobody Knows Me Like the Piano in My Mother's Home. And we didn't get a chance to really talk about the music in Scandal, but the music in Scandal was wonderful and always made the show happen at such a great clip, and I like to think that this song could have appeared in a later season of Scandal.
No one knows me like the piano in my mother's home. You would show me I had something some people call a soul.
This would definitely be like one of those, you know, come to Jesus kind of moments for Olivia Pope, where she's like walking in the cold wind of D.C. and wrapping her Eileen Fisher sweater around her arms going, I've got to get out of here.
It's true, although the one thing about the music of Scandal is like I noticed
it's all old soul.
It leaned so hard, though, especially on Stevie. Stevie Wonder was a major plot point in a couple of the seasons.
Yeah.
But part of me could see this on Grey's Anatomy, for sure.
Oh, yes. Because yeah. They did break so many, like, new musicians.
Yeah.
Whereas Scandal was pretty devoted to, like, yeah, the Sam Cooks and the older soul stuff.
Well, speaking of older soul, this week, my jam is Kacey Musgraves' High Horse. Look, the gay boys have been telling me that I had to buy it or had to listen to it. I'm old and I buy things. And I bought it and it's pretty damn good. Let's hear it. All I want is for every female vocalist to sell out and go super pop for at least one album, and then she can go return to whatever roots or like real human emotions she wants to. And the thing about the album is that it goes pop-tastic at times, it gets pretty country at times, but it's good solid work. And as we head into summer jam season, it's just nice to know like that she and Janelle are, you know, laying a solid foundation for us as we head into summer.
We need that solid foundation.
We need that solid foundation. It's what, like, in April and May, you get your last snows in the Sierras and a couple of decent pop songs.
I've been very Casey curious. So, like, I think now I'm encouraged to just, like, listen to the whole album.
Yes. All right. You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler and Karen Tongson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Also, I shouldn't be plugging two things of mine at the same time, but I do still have a TV show on, and ratings help. Thank you to Ruby Quippers for their review in Apple Podcasts. Ruby wrote, "Very intelligent people talking about fun stuff. Please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We all know that it keeps Margaret healthy and sane, okay? She could turn into an unstable anti-heroine if we don't get enough
reviews.
Right. But that would probably make this a better show, so.
That's true, too.
Yes.
But keep me in Prozac, people. You don't want to see what happens if I don't have it.
Thanks to Real Sesta. They wrote, "I love hearing pop culture discussed by smart people in informed, non-pedantic tones. The conversation..." That's pretty chill to Slate's Culture Gab Fest, isn't it? That was me saying that. "The conversations are fun and human and timely and interesting and reassure me I'm not the only one talking to my media. It's great and the only pop culture podcast for me." That's so wonderful.
Oh,
if you haven't already, please review us.
See, that's like lithium for my soul.
Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. Join in our Facebook group and get in the discussion. Or come to our Instagram account. How is it going, Margaret?
It's a lot of fun over there, Guy. Where have you been?
I need not participating in Instagram enough because I am old and not beautiful enough.
But at Pop Rocket Podcast. Please drop by. We posted something about Crazy Rich Asians today. But that's the kind of content you're going to get.
And we occasionally have some stories up in there, too.
Yeah, noodle times.
I need to be paying more attention. Honestly.
What, you talked about your career as a bun model, and you've just been leaving this on the table unclaimed.
You need to know I'm only really going to engage with you on Instagram once it starts getting videos of Silas walking and saying words. Then I'm going to be all over. All right. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. Our show is edited by Julian Burrell, and our producer is the lovely Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.